Welcome to TWIL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on September 25th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland's Francis King Carey School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
Today, a great pleasure to welcome Jessica Mantel, professor of law at the University of Houston Law Center, where she also co-directs Houston's Health Law and Policy Institute. Jessica is an expert on the rapidly changing landscape of healthcare organizations and delivery. Welcome, Jessica.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here today.
So, Jessica, this is Frank, and I just wanted to say we are so pleased to have you on today. I just recall your great presentation back in the 2011 conference on accountable care organizations that we had back when I was at Seton Hall. And I've been following your work since then, your very insightful work on the Medicare payment reforms and changes to the healthcare finance and regulation landscape. And I was wondering if you could lead us off today with a description of payment reforms that have been part of Medicare over, say, the past decade. And I think that'll provide a good foundation for our discussion of some of your later work.
Sure, love to do that. So a lot is going on the Medicare payment side right now, particularly after the enactment of the Affordable Care Act. And really, you know, when you first look at it, you say, well, the goal here is to, you know, improve quality and lower costs. But more broadly speaking, these reforms are aimed at fundamentally changing how healthcare is delivered in this country. And specifically, there's this big push to move away from a fragmented system where we have small solo practitioners or small physician groups and moving to large healthcare organizations. So I really think we're moving into this era where we're no longer going to have physicians be the dominant provider, and instead we're going to be in this era with large healthcare organizations calling the shots. So talking a little bit about what Medicare reform is doing to bring that about, we're moving away from the traditional fee-for-service world, and that did start in the 1980s, but there's really even a bigger push towards that now. So fee-for-service, as most people know, is when healthcare providers are paid for each unit of care that they provide, regardless of the quality of care being provided and regardless of the outcomes of that care. And that really encouraged providers to focus on, you know, providing very sophisticated care, as much care as possible, leave no stone unturned, and it had a big inflationary effect on healthcare. And so now we're trying to figure out how do we, you know, move back from that and lower cost. And these various reforms are now linking providers' payments to how well they perform on various quality and cost measures. And the thing is that smaller providers just really aren't well equipped to adjust to these reforms on their own. They just don't have the expertise or the wherewithal to be successful under these payment reforms. And it's pushing us towards larger healthcare organizations. Doctors don't want to be in small groups anymore. They're becoming employees of hospitals or employees of healthcare systems. So do you want me to talk a little bit about what those specific reforms are? I know I've talked about the end result of that.
Yes, I think that giving listeners a sense of exactly how particularly the system deals with problems of risk adjustment. Because I think one of the issues that comes up is, I think there was even this study that we discussed on the show last week or the week before saying that readmissions penalties seem to be having a disproportionate effect, say, on hospitals that had a lot of at-risk or high morbidity patients. And so getting into the question of how can, say, a more population-based approach or a more sort of value-based purchasing or pay-for-performance approach adjust for the fact that the patient mixes of different providers can be very different, I think that would be very helpful.
Sure. So you've sort of touched on what these payment reforms are doing. So they evaluate how good a job a provider, whether it be a hospital or a large physician group or an accountable care organization, how good a job they're doing in improving patient outcomes and lowering cost. The thing is, if you think about it, that's going to be impacted a lot by the mix of patients that a provider has. So a provider that has lower income patients, they tend to have higher risk factors, so they tend to be more costly patient and need more care. And if you didn't adjust for that, that provider might look like they're not doing as good a job keeping their patients healthy or not doing as good a job of keeping costs down. So the Medicare program, and Medicaid does this as well, does risk adjustment, where we try to take into account who your patient population is. Are they sicker than average or less sick than average? And it's definitely not an exact science. We're still trying to figure out what factors to take into consideration to make sure that we really are appropriately adjusting for differences in providers' patient populations.
That's really good, Jessica. Let's continue down this sort of line for a while, because before we get to this latest draft that you've got out, which is really fascinating, I think it would behooves us to sort of talk a little more generally about some of the moving pieces. And you have many moving pieces in this article. So I wondered first if you could just give us a little sort of sense of accountable care organizations, which I'm figuring most of our listeners will know about, but perhaps not many will know as much about the patient-centered home pieces that colleagues like Sally Sanford have written about and so on. So I wondered if you could sort of just sort of nudge those little pieces into our consciousness a little bit.
Sure. So what accountable care organizations are, as most of your listeners probably know, are organizations with at least a group of physicians and often other providers, such as hospitals, that are collectively accountable for the quality and cost of care that they provide. And so, for example, under the Medicare Shared Savings Program, if they together do a good job of lowering the cost of caring for their patient population, usually by keeping them healthier or keeping them out of the hospital, they get a share of the savings. And so patients that are, and so the idea with accountable care organizations is that these providers are going to do a better job working together, providing better coordinated care, but also doing a better job just to keep their patients healthy. And patient-centered medical homes has a similar philosophy. It's again moving away from that individual physician-patient relationship and thinking of the patient as being cared for by a group of providers, and also in the case of patient-centered medical homes, some non-providers. So what the patient-centered medical home model does is it creates interdisciplinary teams that assume responsibility for a patient's health. So the team would obviously include the patient's physicians and maybe nurse practitioners and other healthcare providers, but also would include non-practitioners, so social workers, community health workers, and in some cases, even lawyers. And together they work to try to figure out the best way to keep the patient healthy. Often they're focused on the clinical treatment plan for the patient, but sometimes they'll address non-clinical factors as well, such as the fact that the patient is getting sick a lot because there's mold in their apartment and they're having trouble getting their landlord to address that problem. So it's similar to the ACO in the sense that it's this group that's collectively responsible for patients, but it's a little bit more this interdisciplinary team model that may or may not necessarily have financial accountability for the quality and cost outcomes the way the accountable care organization does. And we're starting to see a merger of the two models in that a lot of accountable care organizations are adopting that interdisciplinary team approach that we see with patient-centered medical homes. So sometimes you have sort of this merged ACO that is also a patient-centered medical home because they're doing that interdisciplinary team model.
That seems to make a lot of sense. So moving beyond sort of the value-based purchasing, the ACO, patient-centered homes, and so on, which I guess we could sort of collectively think of as carrots, right, for the providers, and moving a little bit into sticks, you have written about 501R3, which is a provision that I dare not tread in. But I think you could do a great job in explaining how that fits in.
I think what we're starting to talk about, right, is providers being a little less focused on simply treating and diagnosing patients and assuming more responsibility for the overall health of their community. And that whole idea is reflected in these new Section 501R requirements that you talked about. And these are new tax requirements that apply to nonprofit hospitals that are tax exempt under Section 501c3 of the tax code. And to maintain their tax exemption, hospitals have to every 3 years do what's called a community health needs assessment, sometimes called a CHINA. And what that thing is they have to identify significant health needs in their community, including non-clinical factors that impact health. And then they have to come up with a plan that prioritizes these needs and a plan for actually addressing these needs. And so it's encouraging hospitals to think a little bit beyond simply treating and diagnosing patients to what can we, the hospital, do to address our community's health needs, including non-clinical needs or what we call social determinants of health.
And these non-clinical needs are just so important to getting a handle on major health problems. I think you show that really well in the draft we saw and some other work. And one of the things I was wondering if you could address is, I know that you're somewhat pessimistic about government spending more to address the social determinants of health, and you believe that providers should step into that void and take steps to address the social determinants of health. And so I guess my questions would be, why have providers generally not tried to do that yet? And what do you think is different now that will lead today's providers to be more interested in addressing social determinants of health?
So you're right that historically, providers really have not done too much to address the social determinants of health. And there's a couple historical reasons for that. The first is that at some point in the 20th century, we saw a separation in the education of physicians and public health advocates. So specifically, we saw medical schools form and focus on what we call the biomedical paradigm. And then we saw separate public health schools formed, and they focused on these social determinants of health, these sort of upstream factors that impact people's health. So physicians and other practitioners, you know, going through the medical school model, they were taught to focus on the diagnosis and treatment of disease and all that public health stuff. Well, that's the job of those public health graduates, of those public health schools. And that split also got reinforced by the fee-for-service payment system. So, again, with doctors being paid just on this per-unit basis for each thing they do, They were rewarded for the quantity of care they provided and not for keeping patients healthy. So since they weren't being rewarded for keeping patients healthy, they weren't financially motivated to focus on those social factors that were adversely impacting their patients' health. And in fact, if they did focus on their patients' social factors that were impacting their health and managed to make their patients healthy, they actually suffered a financial penalty under fee for service because then they wouldn't be providing as much care to patients. So they wouldn't be making as much money. So that's historically why we haven't seen physicians and other providers do that much about the social determinants of health. Today, though, that is starting to change. And it's starting to change because of all these payment reforms being implemented under Medicare and Medicaid, as well as the tax law, the Section 501R requirements we just talked about. So the payment reforms include things like value-based purchasing and bundled payments and hospital readmissions and shared savings. These are all programs that financially reward providers for keeping their patients healthier and for lowering cost. And so far, primarily, providers have tried to, in response to these incentives, have tried to do a better job of how they treat patients in the clinical setting. But some more forward-thinking providers are also starting to appreciate, hey, you know, if I also do something about the social factors that are causing my patients to be in poorer health, I can also then improve their health status and reduce healthcare spending. And so we're starting to see this trend of providers moving beyond that traditional biomedical paradigm and starting to focus more and more on the social determinants of health as a way to be more successful under these new payment reforms.
So let's talk a little bit, if we may, about some examples here, so sort of things that healthcare providers are beginning to do or maybe you think they should be doing. A couple that struck me, I know that Mount Sinai has, in large part to tackle the readmission issue, has brought in teams of social workers who now work with those sort of frequent flyer patients, as they're sometimes pejoratively called, who work with them out in their homes and so on to try and work through issues for them and keep them from coming back to the hospital. In Indianapolis, here where we are, we have a public hospital, an extraordinarily good public hospital, the Ashkenazi Hospital, and that actually is moving into the real estate business. They have apartment complexes, transitional homes, some of which are just for persons with serious mental illnesses, but others are much more general. And I wondered, sort of along that line of thought, what other sorts of initiatives do you see out there or do you think would be useful?
So, you know, you've hit on some great examples of providers doing things well beyond simply diagnosing and treating medical care or medical conditions. So, you know, some providers are focused, I would say, at the individual patient level. So they identify that a patient has some food insecurity issues. Maybe it's a diabetic that's having trouble managing their diabetes because they don't have enough money left to buy food at the end of the month. And so they may be doing things like linking that individual to resources that are available to help them. So they might help that patient enroll in SNAP, the food stamps program. You mentioned housing. Maybe it's helping that patient get some sort of public assistance for housing because as we know, stable housing can definitely help keep people healthier. Health leads is another example that a lot of providers are getting involved in various cities across the country. With health leads, providers send to health leads a prescription for food or for heat, and health lead volunteers will fill those prescriptions by helping the patient get connected to community resources available to them. Medical legal partnerships is something we've just seen an explosion of. You alluded to those in your remarks, Nick, but this is lawyers, you know, helping patients address issues that are adversely impacting their health. So a really common one is suing landlords who are not in compliance with local housing standards. So there's mold or lead paint or just a lot of dust that's causing health problems. So these are the kinds of things happening more at a patient-specific level. There are some providers moving to a little bit more community-level interventions and maybe even addressing the community infrastructure. So there's examples of hospitals that are starting to do Meals on Wheels for their patients or helping to bring a new grocery store into what's otherwise a food desert where it's hard for people to get access to fresh fruits and vegetables, or supporting after-school programs so that youth have a safe space to go and where maybe they can get some physical exercise. And then maybe just hands-on intensive programs addressing behavioral factors that contribute to poor health. So providers doing smoking cessation programs or parenting program or even meditation. I mean, there's just a long, long list of different things that providers are starting to do across the country.
I guess another approach is to sort of come from the other direction and start to take a sort of a broader view as to what clinical care is about. And I think the Institute of Medicine has sort of started pushing us down that road. We've talked here a couple of times before in the context of electronic health records and the Meaningful Use Program about the IOM recommendations as to social and behavioral domains being included in electronic health records going forward. And, you know, we sort of talked about race, ethnicity, education, employment, and finances and so on. Certainly the IOM thought food and housing insecurity was one of those issues. Dietary patterns, physical activity, tobacco use and exposure, and general types of sort of literacy that could impact the person. I wonder whether we might look back maybe in 5 years, 10 years' time, and in fact, the very sort of clinical base of medicine is a lot different from how we see it today.
You know, I think that's right. I mean, right now, when you see surveys of physicians, they acknowledge that these, you know, social determinants of health have a huge impact on their patients' health. And they frankly may have a bigger impact on patients' health than the type of medical care they get. I mean, a lot of people think social determinants of health accounts for as much as 60% of preventable deaths. And the problem, though, is physicians just, they don't feel that well equipped to wander into this world. But I think as they become part of larger organizations, these organizations may be better equipped to start to address these issues. And so I think you will see doctors sort of nudged in the direction of, when they examine a patient, not just asking the traditional medical questions, but starting to ask things like, do you have food insecurity problems? Are you experiencing any domestic violence issues? Is there stress in your life? Is there economic hardship? I mean, the types of things that might impact their health. And then when those things are identified in that sort of initial physician-patient interaction, that would then kick into effect others within these larger organizations taking steps to address those issues. So the referral to the medical legal partnership, the referral to the social worker that's going to help the patient enroll in food stamps and so on. And so I think you're right that our idea of what a healthcare provider does will be much broader than this traditional clinical model of just simply diagnosing and treating disease.
Well, these integrated community health systems that you're describing, Jessica, really do sound very exciting in terms of really meeting human needs and addressing the root causes of a lot of healthcare overutilization. I'm wondering, though, it sounds like in order to get people the benefits they need, in order to make sure that their housing is safe, that nutritious food is available, that there are opportunities for exercise, that there's going to be a lot of cross-sector data sharing going on. And I'm wondering, given all of the difficulties even in sharing health data among providers, what are the challenges facing the doctors, facing the managers of these systems, once non-providers and non-clinical data are put into the mix?
So that's a great question, Frank. Let me just step back for a second and talk about what I term integrated community health system, something you referred to. So when I talk about sort of in response to Nick's question, I talked about providers, you know, having a broader view. There's still a lot of limits of what providers can do on their own. I mean, providers, even a healthcare system, you know, probably doesn't have the expertise or the resources to go about building playgrounds or, addressing a lot of the infrastructure problems that may be going on in the community. And so when I talk about integrated community health systems, I'm talking about providers linking not only with one another, but with other sectors to try to address social determinants of health. So imagine where hospitals and physicians and other providers in the community are working with the local public health department and schools and employers and community groups to address specific needs. So maybe collectively they're taking a multi-pronged approach to try to figure out how to reduce childhood obesity or type 2 onset of diabetes. So a very different model than even these integrated delivery systems and accountable care organizations that we're talking about today. So you're right, though, that to be successful, these cross-sector collaborations require a tremendous amount of data sharing, and usually data being shared electronically. And, you know, there's examples of people doing these collaborations, not too many examples, though, but when I read about them, you always see a couple sentences or two in the literature saying, oh, yeah, there's some privacy and IT challenges here with respect to exchanging all this data. And I think the truth is we don't quite have a firm grasp yet of what those challenges are. And I hope to spend the next year or two trying to get a better sense of what the challenges are by interviewing people doing these cross-sector collaborations. So the types of issues that I want to ask and types of things I anticipate finding is I want to find out if there's any of these cross-sector data exchanges that are not happening, either because of the technology challenges or maybe because of privacy concerns and specifically concerns that these exchanges might violate HIPAA. So, for example, I think providers may be nervous about sharing information with entities that aren't technically business associates under the HIPAA privacy rule. But if you think about the types of entities they may be working with, so a church group, a local housing shelter, I mean, these are entities that are really not going to be in a position to meet the business associate requirements, and that could be a barrier to sort of the data sharing among those types of entities. Definitely interoperability challenges. I mean, as Nick could probably speak to for a long time, we haven't quite figured out how to exchange clinical data. And now here we are talking about throwing non-clinical data or social determinants of health related data into the mix. The big, big challenge there is that data is not standardized. I mean, social workers do not have a consistent way of recording the types of data they gather from clients. So we got to figure out how to address that. Other concerns is that some of that data, the social determinants of health data, may be really sensitive. I mean, it may be information like household income or whether or not their individual is a victim of domestic violence in their household. We might need to have laws that provide heightened protection for that kind of information, the same way we now give heightened protection to mental health data or substance abuse medical records. And Nick had mentioned before, with electronic health record standards, we need to figure out how to incorporate the social determinants of health data into that if we're going to have providers in the clinical setting starting to ask more about social determinants of health issues from their patients. And then another issue, too, is that some of these collaborations might operate across state lines. And a lot of times there's conflicting state laws. And that, too, might then be a barrier for these collaborations and the data sharing that they want to do. So I think a lot of really complicated privacy and security and IT issues will be identified with these with cross-sector collaborations, and that we have to start digging into figuring out what exactly they are, and from a regulatory perspective, what can we do to sort of lower some of these barriers while still providing adequate privacy protection for individuals.
Yeah, there's a real push-pull about that, isn't there, at the moment? I mean, the SAMHSA regs, the behavioral substance abuse regs, those rules are being blamed at the moment in Congress for a lot of the barriers to data sharing. And yet, as you say, those particular records are some of the most sensitive that could be in a health record. So a slightly different angle on this, taking us back to our day jobs, Jessica and Frank, in the classroom. I wonder to what extent in this sort of changing world and to deal with the issues that Jessica raises, we're actually going to sort of have to change the way we approach our health law classes a little bit. Is it enough that we spend our time dealing with Affordable Care Act doctrine, a lot of which we've just been through, some of the most important pieces, but I wonder to what extent we need to bring sort of housing into the picture. How many health lawyers, for example, over this semester have been talking about the Inclusive Communities Projects case, the Kennedy decision last term, holding that a disparate impact was permissible under FHA HUD rules. Or even to go back to something like we maybe do in first year torts. You'd mentioned lead paint, Jessica. There's that incredibly interesting case in Wisconsin, the Thomas and Hallett case, in which the court, a very divided court, in a very controversial opinion, applied market share liability and essentially switched the burden of persuasion onto the pigment manufacturers. It led to pigment manufacturers actually campaigning or paying for campaigns against the judge who wrote the lead opinion, who was the first sort of Wisconsin judge to be thrown out for like 40 years or something like that. So I wondered, just the two of you, and maybe sort of wrapping up now, as to whether there are things that either we need to bring into our introduction to health law classes or maybe bolster some of our electives in health law centers in particular, and we all are in those, to better approach some of these issues.
Well, I think as you both know, health law is already so broad and it's so hard to cover all the relevant issues in a class. It's hard for me to imagine trying to shove even more issues to a health law class in one semester. But I think you're right that the idea of the healthcare lawyer may change somewhat. I mentioned lawyers being part of these interdisciplinary teams under the patient-centered medical home model, and they're going to often be dealing with what we might not right now think of as health law issues, like housing, or it could be family law issues coming into play. And so we may need what we think of as healthcare lawyers needing to be prepared to spot those issues. But I think, sort of speaking a little more broadly, we also have to think about training lawyers to be part of these teams with all these non-lawyers there, the social workers and the physicians and the nurses and others on these committees. Right now, all, the medical students, the social work students, public health students, everyone's at a different program, a different grad school, and there's not a lot of interaction among these different types of students. And now we're throwing them into this whole new world and saying, work together as part of a team. So speaking sort of beyond just health law and a little bit more of graduate education training, I think we do have to start thinking about, at the education level, introducing our students to what these other team members do so they can understand each other and learn how to work together. And there's a few examples of that happening. So I think it was Emory University brought together law students along with medical students and public health students and social work students for a day-long conference. And they basically shared with each other, here's what I do and here's my perspective. And then you could give students a hypothetical patient and be like, what can we do to help this patient? And I think it's very eye-opening for the medical student to hear what the law student or the social worker or the public health student has to say, and similarly for the others to hear what the medical student's perspective. So that's a whole other part of our education system we probably need to be thinking about, is this sort of preparing students for a world of interdisciplinary teamwork.
If I may very quickly interject a quick plug for my colleague Heather McCabe, who at our shop teaches a cross-disciplinary teamwork course in public health law for law students and social work students, and really is trying to push in that very way.
Yes, and at University of Maryland, we've got some really good interprofessional education initiatives with the president of the university and some folks from public health and the law school and med school that I think are going in this direction, and also especially with the lead paint problem. I think that we were working in that direction. And I think in general, one thing I emphasize in my class when I talk about the 5% of individuals who drive over 50% of the healthcare spending, according to AHRQ, is that part of being a good health lawyer is to understand what are the needs of this population. And I can foresee that we're going to have a lot more training about the facts on the ground, the social science, the overall public health landscape, to really prepare students in the future to be effective health attorneys.
I think so. And I have heard your colleagues talk about the programs at both of your schools, and they're great. And I think, your universities are ahead of the curve on this, and hopefully will serve as models for other schools.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A special thank you to Jessica Mantel for joining us. Jessica, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
We post our show notes at twill.com. Also at twill.com, you'll see a link to our crowdfunding page. If you'd like to support the show, you can contact me at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. And Frank?
I'm at Frank Pasquale on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.